I think there was a little public service announcement hidden in that children's sermon about strangers and candy and other stuff like that. But Lily knocked it out of the park. It was great. The heart was right there. We're going to be in Matthew chapter 15. It's page 949 in your pew Bible right in front of you, the blue Bible, if you need it. I had a really good week. I haven't been sick. Been watching basketball. NBA TV is free online right now for like two or three more days. So this guy who loves basketball and doesn't have cable can watch basketball for two more days. So it's been a good week. Nothing bad, no funny, crazy antics. So with that, I guess to make up for it, I'm going to tell the most embarrassing story of my life this morning. I have to draw back a little bit. It was in 2006, and it was just after my college graduation, and I was co-leading a team of college students. I was in full-time campus ministry. We went down to New Orleans to do some Hurricane Katrina cleanup. We were tasked with gutting houses, ripping them down, and getting rid of all the junk so they could come back and restore what was still left. And I was very excited. I was still a pretty new Christian. I came to faith as a 19-year-old in college. And being a person who was outside of faith and then came into faith, all the Christians on the inside were very excited about me. Like, oh, we didn't know that actually happened. And they thought I was so great because I had this kind of crazy story. And they kind of put me on top of the ladder pretty fast. And they're like, oh, you're going to be such a great leader. You can relate to so many people. And I sort of internalized that a little too quickly before it was actually any good for me. So I wanted to be the next great sort of Christian leader, and I was going to co-lead these people, and we're going to have a great time in New Orleans. And I had to order plane tickets and vans and this and that, and things were going well, except for the first house we went to that we cleaned up. A bunch of guys in hazmat suits showed up, and they said, this place is full of asbestos. You shouldn't have been in here for 2 days. Ooh, that sort of hurt my pride as wanting to be an emerging leader. And then we recovered gradually. And by the end of the week, we did some cool work, and we gutted four or five houses. And to celebrate, after we gutted our last house, you know, I had a group of college kids, and we were goofing around, and one of the freshmen had a video camera, and we're all sort of dancing and mugging for the camera. Sean, do something. You're the leader. Oh, you did such a good job. Do something funny for the camera. I'm not a good dancer. I don't really do good impressions. Oh, I know. I know how to do a cartwheel. So I'll do a cartwheel, and that will be memorable, and that will stand out. So I didn't take into consideration that the streets of New Orleans were just filled with soot and grease and ash because of all the construction that's been going through and all the debris left over. Not to mention, I just helped change a tire on one of our vans that had broken down, so my hands are full of grease. But I'm going to go do a cartwheel because it's funny and I'm in front of a camera and I'm a leader. I don't know. So I kind of get a little bit of a head start. I'm about 10 yards away from the camera. And I plant my hand down, good start. And I sort of get on top. And once my body is sort of 180 degrees, this right hand sort of slides forward as the rest of my body goes over the top. And I ended up crossed over somehow. And then someone shot a gun. And then I fell on my butt. I was like, well, where did that gunshot come from? Oh, why can't I move my arm? And the gunshot was actually my elbow dislocating. And it was in a place it shouldn't have been. And I was sort of stunned. And the adrenaline, I hadn't felt anything yet. I heard the crack. I'm sitting there in the soot. And everyone's like, ah, Sean, come on, get up. Let's go. I'm like, I think I broke my arm. Oh, no, you didn't. Come on, get up. We got to go. Let's stop messing around. No, guys, I really think I broke my arm. Please come over, call 911. I'm delirious at this point. And they all are like, oh, get up, you wuss. They come over, they're like, oh! And they all did the unhelpful squint and point, and they didn't know what to do. So then I was caught in this predicament. I wanted to be like the great leader that was under control at all times. Well, here I am with a dislocated elbow with so much pain going through my body. I couldn't even like wiggle my toes. I was on the ground for an hour or so before paramedics came. And I'm thinking, how do I be a good leader while I'm sitting here with my elbow disjointed? And I was caught between these two places, The reality was, that was the dumbest thing to go through my mind. And I should have just let all my people there sort of take care of me. But I was caught in trying to be something different than what was going on in my inside. And it was sort of this whole mess. Ended a week, I went to the hospital, I got a cast. I looked like RoboCop because it was a big contraption I had on my arm. And I flew home and I rehabbed. And now I have a quirky elbow. And that's the end of the story. I wanted to respond in this perfect leader sort of way to a crisis. I didn't quite make it. That's part of our story this morning. In Matthew 15, I'm going to read the first couple of verses, and we're going to dive into the story here. Leaving that place, Jesus withdrew to the region of Tyre and Sidon. A Canaanite woman from that vicinity came to him crying out, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on me. My daughter is demon-possessed and suffering terribly." Jesus did not answer a word. So his disciples came to him and urged him, "Send her away, for she keeps crying out after us." The Canaanite woman is clearly going to be the prominent figure of this story. But first we have to sort of address the disciples' behavior here. Jesus gives the disciples an opportunity to respond first. You handle it. I'm going to be quiet. I'm going to see how you respond. And like the good Jesus followers that they were, when Jesus is silent even for a moment, they step right in and fill that void. Not unlike us, if we perceive God to be silent about any given circumstance or situation, we're really, really quick to want to make up and sort of contribute some noise and, "Oh, I don't like the silence, so let me try to handle this and fix this and fill in the gaps." The disciples didn't get it right. We're in a series on seeing how Jesus sees. Pastor Jeff opened it up with the John chapter 4 and the woman at the well, and we address sort of the in-out exclusion, inclusion stuff that Lily just talked to the kids about as well. And the disciples, they're still at the point where they're about insiders and outsiders, and they use that language. Their response is not really helpful. "Send her away. She's difficult. Jesus, let's just kind of keep going." Jesus being in Tyre and Sidon, it was almost like a retreat center for him. It's not where he spent the majority of his time. So it's a fair interpretation to say Jesus was trying to get away from the crowd. "Oh, but now somebody needs help. Send her away." Jesus keeps his mouth shut. He lets this play out for a little while. So disciples are keeping the outsiders outside. I don't think that's much of an issue for us in the church these days. I think our issue is more about forcing the outsiders to come inside far too quickly and under our own terms. It's more of like the overzealous thing. Rather than wanting to keep people away, we want to bring them in far too quickly and far too harshly and with the wrong tone and sentiment. In my New Orleans story, I had an example of this too. We actually had a person who wasn't a faith person come with us. Her name was Laura, and for whatever reason, she liked hanging out with the Christian people. She saw that we were up to some kind of good. "Oh, I want to help people. Okay, cool. Come on down with us." She loved being with us, and she was learning from us, and I think we were doing a pretty good job of including her and not making her feel like the outsider, because I don't know, a bunch of Christian college kids. Not like any of you, but in my day, the Christian college kids were just awkward. sorry. But then there was this one night back at the place we were staying. I had walked in, and there was a big group conversation. It wasn't so much a group conversation. It was like 7 or 8 or 9 of the college students literally had Laura pushed up against a wall in a corner, and they were all sort of rapid-fire asking her questions. "What about this? What about that? Well, do you know creation? And do you know that if you don't really believe in Jesus, then all this bad stuff happens?" And it wrecked me. I was like, "Oh, this is bad. This is not the way we want to treat people. This is not the kind of faith we want to model." So again, trying to be the perfect young leader, I said, "Oh, I'll take care of this." So I actually texted one of the savvier people in our group that was over there. I said, take all of those people away and you can stay. And he got it. He had some self-awareness. Hey guys, let's go around the corner. We have to do our next thing, whatever we're doing. So then it was left, and I sort of went over and apologized. I was like, ooh, I would not like to have been cornered like that. I'm really sorry. She said, no, it's fine. But, oh, it was just sort of really uncomfortable. And I don't know. I think that is a modern-day situation of the disciples' error. I think we have sort of the same kind of errors. And it's really interesting to see how Jesus speaks to these errors. He answers in verse 24, I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel. The woman came and knelt before him. Lord, help me, she said. His reply is really interesting. He replied, it is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs. If you're not familiar with the passage, I've heard it referred to lots of times as sort of the Jesus is a jerk passage. And it's harsh. We don't know quite what to do with that verse 26. But I want to shoot back up to verse 24. It's highlighted there on the screen. He answered, I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel. Well, who just talked last? Who or what is he answering? Anybody tracking? The disciples, right? Jesus didn't answer a word. The disciples came, sent her away. So if Jesus is answering anybody right now, he's answering us. He's answering the disciples when he says, I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel. I'm not quite ready to say this is Jesus being a jerk, but he's up to something. I think he's up to two things here. First, I think he's mirroring the disciples. I think he's reflecting, ironically and sarcastically, the lack of compassion that the disciples had on this young woman. And I think it's sort of, hey, send her away. Yeah, you go away, because I was only sent to the lost sheep of Israel. I think the tone of voice was, do you know how stupid you sound right now? And you've been with me so long, you still don't know how I treat people? I think that's a fair guess. He's up to something else, though, that's far more important. The dialogue continues, but before we get to this woman, let's talk about all the stuff that she was up against. Canaanite woman is how she's presented. No name, just geography and gender. Canaanite would be an Old Testament term. In the parallel story in the Gospel of Mark, the woman's called the Syrophoenician woman, which is an up-to-date geographical description. Canaanite is like the old-school geographical description. And would call to mind the book of Joshua and all these things where, oh, the Israelites have to drive the Canaanites out of the land. So the disciples and probably even the reader, when they see that, is going to be like, ah, this is the woman who shouldn't even be around anymore. She's one of those. So that's like the first strike. She's a woman in this era. Not a lot of rights. Not a lot of people standing up for her. The fact that she has to go and make her own way and find someone to take care of her sick, oppressed daughter is telling. No advocate. No one to stand up for her. And then she's trying to help out her daughter. And then there's the presence of the in crowd, the disciples, the mean girls. That's who the disciples are right here. And it's got to be a really hard thing to express this really vulnerable need. I mean, my daughter is demon oppressed and she's suffering terribly. Who wants to say that in front of the religious insiders, the people with the sway? That takes some guts. So she's behind the eight ball on that one, too. It's just a frankly desperate situation. It's probably embarrassing. And then there's the whole Jesus is silent. I just expressed my deepest, most heartfelt need, and Jesus is silent, and he lets the mean girls have the first word. There's a lot going on, and there's a lot of reasons for this woman to be really discouraged and to give up really quick, but she keeps going. Verse 27, yes, it is, Lord. Even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table. Then Jesus said to her, "Woman, you have great faith. Your request is granted." And her daughter was healed at that moment. What happened so quickly? Some people want to say that this woman got the best of Jesus, like it was a showdown, and she got the best of him, and she convinced Jesus to do something that he probably wasn't going to do in the beginning of the interaction. Not too sure about that one. Other people are going to say, Jesus was just kind of being nice. He's just having pity. He wasn't really into dealing with the lots of outsiders, but this one, okay, just I'll heal your daughter, but I'm going to send you away now. I don't think that's quite it either. Here's what I think is going on, and I'm going to use a term that hopefully some of our business and economists and business students will resonate with. Opportunity costs. Is anybody familiar with this phrase? Paul. Thanks, Paul. Opportunity costs. Here's a brief definition. A benefit, profit, or value of something that must be given up to acquire or achieve something else. It's a value thing. Now, the Canaanite woman had nothing to offer Jesus. No money, probably not a lot of resources. She's not saying, hey, I'll pay you for this good and or service. No. The value is within her. It's my guess, and I think this is close to on the money, that Jesus is showing the woman that she herself is worth fighting for. You have value, but you don't quite know it yet. He's forcing her to give up all these traditional, hurtful, exclusionary reasons for her to give up on this. It's not about you being a Canaanite outsider. It's not you being the wrong gender in a patriarchal society. It's not about this in-crowd being around. It's not about me not responding as quickly as you would like. He sort of makes her fight through each and every one of these. Just like Jesus mirrored that lack of compassion to the disciples, showing them how wrong they got it, I think he's mirroring to her how he sees her. I think Jesus literally picture a mirror and picture this woman interacting with him, and she looks into the mirror of Jesus' eyes, and in his eyes, she sees for the very first time her worth and her value and her dignity as a woman created in the image of God. And it's a mirror that she was not going to get in any other part of her culture. I think that's what Jesus is up to right here. He had to show her that in his eyes, she was worth fighting for. And he wasn't going to be able to talk her into it. I think that's why he really digs in and says, no, you have to fight for this. I know it's in you, but you don't know it's in you. And I can't sermonize it, and I can't convince you of it. So we're going to have this interaction, and you're going to have to go after it. She gets it. And I think we see that she gets it, not just because Jesus blessed her and answered her prayer. I think it's about the language that she uses. I think she goes from religious talk to real, raw, gritty, primal. Oh, this is who I am. I can do this. She starts with what? Lord, Son of David, have mercy on me. For a Canaanite, for a Syrophoenician, that would be sort of, she's using the wrong language. The disciples would say, you don't talk like that, we talk like that. I think the woman knows enough and is savvy enough to use language that Jesus would resonate with, but he doesn't resonate with it for her sake. Lord, Son of David, have mercy on me, gets met with what? Silence. Huh. Okay, well, Lord, I really need this. Lord, help me. She gets a little more direct, a little more assertive, and that opens up the conversation. Okay, I could see that you really want this, young lady. I think we'll continue this. Then they have this repartee, and he essentially calls her a dog. There's no way around it. Technically, it's like a puppy. That's the word that's used. So maybe you might be a cute dog, but you're still a dog. And once she once she takes hold and says, I'm not leaving here. I know this is for me. And she rebuts Jesus. She comes right back at him and says, no, I'm not accepting that. Even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table. She gets commendation. You have great faith. You're willing to come at me like that? You're worth it. You're worth it. Isn't it interesting that Jesus doesn't just solve or fix problems? He usually engages on a deeper level first. He usually wants to know what's stirring behind the person. It's the gritty side of it. Do you really, really want it? Do you really, really want it? I'm going to deviate for a second. Anybody aware of or have seen already the movie Glory? Not Glory. Fury. Thank you. Glory is a good movie, too. Anybody see Fury or aware of the story? All right, so it's a World War II. Brad Pitt and Shia LaBeouf and a bunch of other good actors, and it's a raw, gritty, violent story. Shia LaBeouf plays a Christian guy, and I haven't seen the movie, but I've been following along, and Shia LaBeouf, there was this really interesting interview he had last week, and he's a method actor. That means he gets into character, he doesn't break character. Apparently, one of the things he felt like he had to do was pull one of his own teeth out on set so that he would know how a veteran, a World War II soldier, would have to take care of a cavity. So he extracted a tooth because he's a method actor and he wants to feel every single thing that the person he's representing felt. Well, being a method actor and playing a Christian, Shia LaBeouf had to sort of get into the zone. And there was this interview last week where he said, you know what? For that place at that time, I became a Christian. And I didn't do it in this half-hearted sort of way. Like, no. I mean, I read the script and I prayed the scripted prayers, but I meant it, and it took. Since we're moving from religious to raw, the next slide is going to be slightly PG-13, perhaps rated R, but edited for television. This is Shia LaBeouf's quote. Excuse me ahead of time, direct your emails to Pastor Jeff. This is Shia LaBeouf's quote. I became a Christian man, and not in a bleeping bull bleep way. This is serious. In a very real way. I could have just said the prayers that were on the page, but it was a real thing that really saved me. And you can't identify unless you're going through it. It's a full-blown exchange of heart, a surrender of control. If that isn't the rawest, realest, grittiest, up-to-date version of what it is to encounter Christ, I don't know what else. Now, let's put Shia off to the side, because if you read the whole story, he talks about how, no, it really was just a role, but I really felt it. His story's not over yet. But let's take the words at face value. I think this is the thing that Jesus was trying to pull out of the Canaanite woman. Are you going to do this in a way that once you get what you need, and then I'm going to send you off, and that's all you wanted? Or can we have this interaction soul to soul and heart to heart, and when by the time this is over, something will have changed? I've learned a lot from Pastor Martin in a couple years that he's been here with us. And the sense that I get from him is when he interacts with people is, do you really want it? If you really want it, we'll do it right now. But if you don't want to do it right now, get out of my face. Is that fair? I got the shrug. I got the nodding shrug. No, it's really become a lens in how I see Jesus interact with people. He wants to make sure that you want it. And if you want it, if you're ready, I don't care about the disciples, I don't care about your gender, I don't care where you're coming from, I don't care how broken you are, I don't care if you don't realize how broken you are, we're going to do this right here, right now, and all my attention is on you. That's the double vision of Jesus. Jesus has this issue with the disciples. They're being jerks. They're lacking compassion. He has to deal with them, and he does, by making fools of them. This is what you're doing. You're lacking compassion. You hear how I sound? That's how you sound. Don't do that. He mirrored the wrong response so that he could model the right response. And then Jesus in the presenting problem. The presenting problem is this woman has a need. Her daughter's sick. She needs to be healed. Okay, it's a kingdom problem. There is darkness in the world. The King of Kings can deal with a kingdom problem. And he did. He addressed it, and the young lady, the daughter, was healed. But first, before we get to the presenting problem, let's get to the real deal. Why are you here? What do you want? Let's go for it, if you're ready to go for it. Jesus and his soul. He took her further than she could have ever imagined when she made her first request. She found her voice. He didn't give it to her. It's really important. He didn't say, this is who you are, this is what I see. No, no, no. You got to work for it because it's inside you already. So you're going to come and get it. She found her voice. I like this phrase. She shouted herself into the kingdom. She used it. I'm not letting go of this until I get what I need. What she needed was far beyond her initial expectation. I think Shia LaBeouf nails it. I think seeing what Jesus sees is seeing what needs to happen in the moment, but acting on behalf of the kingdom. The further, the deeper, the soul stuff, the soul side. We have needs every day, and people come to us every day. Address the needs, but make it a kingdom moment. This is a great day. It's a communion day. We celebrate the Lord's table together as a family. That's what's going to happen in the moment, communion. What's going to be the kingdom outcome for you? How are you going to come up here to take the words of our actor friend and make sure communion isn't done in a bleepity bleep bleep way like usual, but it's a real thing that really happens and you really feel it? I want everyone to stand up all together. No one's got singled out yet. And this isn't just a game. Seriously, look around. Like, look around behind you, look around. We're all coming to the Lord's table together. Each one of us can identify with different people in the story. Some of us are the disciples who are far too exclusionary. Some of us are the woman who just come to Jesus over and over because we have need after need after need after need. Some of us need that soul connection that Jesus comes after us with. But we all come to the table together. And since we're all coming to the table together anyway, let's come to the table in the real, raw, gritty way from the examples we have today. If you're stirred up and you can't quite put your finger on it, but you know that this sentiment is the kind of faith you need to embrace, and you need to drop the religious jargon and stop doing the, Lord, please, well, Lord, please, and go from all the nicey, nice religious stuff to going for it with Jesus. He's drawn you into that. Since we're already standing, and since we're coming to the table together already, and you need a faith that isn't blankety-blank BS, you want this in a very real way, whether it's first-time faith or something new, something better, something different, just raise your hand. You're standing already. We're coming to the table together already. That's it. Put your hands down. That's the only response. Let's come to the table honestly. Sit back down. Now, you had the guts to raise your hand. Here's what I want from you. All of you who raise your hand, I want you to be first in line for communion. I want you to fight. You got the disciples around you. You're a little weary about how this is going to look. I want you to fight. And for you today, fighting means coming to the table first, because Jesus is saying, it's your time, you first, come get it. All right? Pastor Jeff's going to come and give some of the traffic instructions. And as he does, the last thing he's going to say is, the first people come first. You come for the bread, you come for the cup, and if you need, there's going to be prayer people, and you tell them, I want this to be a not BS thing, and we're in it together. Pastor Jeff?